wind blew through the hills, whistling as it found the crevices and tumbled down walls and rustling the grasses growing up between the paving stones. The shepherd raised his voice over the din, shouting at his two sons and aging dog to keep the flock moving. Slate-gray clouds were gathering above the hills, threatening rain to go along with a howling breeze. The vast expanse of ruins would offer some shelter, thought the shepherd. Some said that the place was cursed, that the people who had lived here offended the gods and provoked their wrath, and so they stayed away from the massive carved stone blocks of the fortification walls. Better to get soaked in a storm or suffer the biting cold of autumn gusts than risk the anger of the gods. The shepherd knew better. His grandfather had lived in the city as a boy, the son of a soldier serving the kings who had once lived there. The city wasn't cursed, as grandfather had told him. Maybe the old kings of Hati had angered the gods. The storm god Teshub had been strong here. But it had been the people who had burned the city, not Teshub's lightning bolts. The shepherd's grandfather had told him of hurriedly fleeing Hattusha before the raiders arrived, the palls of smoke hanging in the air, the omnipresent scent of burning wafting through the hills. There was nothing to fear here now aside from twisting an ankle on an unseen, half-buried piece of debris. The gray clouds gathered above the ruins, casting into darkness the faces of the two massive, carved animal figures flanking either side of the gate. They brightened when lightning flashed in the sky, stone mouths threatening to swallow the shepherd and his entire flock whole before plunging back into shadow as the lightning passed. A few seconds later, thunder followed the flash, booming and echoing through the abandoned streets beyond. The shepherd paused. At that moment, he could understand why so many people avoided the old city. His grandfather's assurances seemed paltry next to the wrath of the storm god. Why tempt a vengeful god? The shepherd shook his head, and the moment passed. The bleating of sheep, his son's yells, and the barking of his old dog brought him back to reality. The city was dead, a relic of a long past age. There was nothing to fear. As the rapid rupture of the Bronze Age collapse settled into a less acute instability, people had to get on with their lives. Collapse might be the end of something, but it's always the beginning of another. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. In the story we tell about the Bronze Age, the collapse is the climax of the narrative. Everything leads up to that point. We look for causes, the seeds planted decades or even centuries before, climatic shifts, and the flaws inherent in the system that defined a world of trade, communication, mobility, and politics stretching from Iran to the Adriatic. And we cast our gaze on the burned palaces, the cities razed to the ground, bronze arrowheads scattered in the streets, unburied human remains left in collapsed buildings, massive battles, and the streams of migrants searching for a new home. Collapse looms large in our imagination, and with good reason, because collapse is dramatic. It's also important. One of the defining features of collapse, as we've discussed in the past few episodes of Tides, is that they involve human suffering on a significant scale. People die when crops fail due to droughts or cold snaps. People die when cities burn. People die when they're forced, not choose, but are forced, to undertake migrations under less than ideal circumstances. When food is scarce, political order disappears, and uncertainty reigns, the knives tend to come out. We see some of the worst aspects of the human character under circumstances like these, and it's essential to understand why people behave in this fashion. Mass suffering is a bad thing. I don't think that's controversial. And understanding how and why it comes about is essential to either avoiding it or minimizing its effects in the future if it is unavoidable. Unfortunately, as it turns out, collapse is a recurring feature in the historical and archaeological record, not a once-in-a-blue-moon type of thing. Coming to terms with collapse is a fundamental part of grappling with the nature of how human societies function over long timescales. That's why I've spent such a considerable chunk of time breaking down the Bronze Age collapse, one of the most geographically widespread and widely discussed instances of the phenomenon. But there's a problem with this approach. I've presented the Bronze Age collapse as not only the end of a substantial run of episodes on the Bronze Age, but as the culmination of this entire season on prehistory and early historic societies. This is intentional. Again, collapse is dramatic. If you're trying to tell a story, even one hewing closely to the scholarly consensus on topics as distant from one another as Homo erectus and Proto-Indo-European and New Kingdom Egypt, you need to have some kind of structure. Story structure involves beginnings and ends, rising action, and of course the climax. For our purposes, the Bronze Age collapse is the climax. By the way, it's fine if that hasn't been on your radar as you've been listening to these episodes. I'm not bothered either way because it's as much for me to give shape to the work I'm doing as it is for the people who are engaging with the story I'm telling. Anyway, this is the nature of stories. They have a structure, whether we realize it or not. The better the story, the stronger the structure. But there's a trade-off here. Structuring a story requires us to pick and choose the things we talk about. We can't talk about everything or give everything we do talk about equal emphasis. We choose what goes first, what goes in the middle, and what comes at the end. And because we know what's coming at the end, that shapes the way we present what came before it, too. No good ending comes out of the blue. There always needs to be a buildup in order to have a payoff. But the past isn't a story. We might tell it as a story because we understand the world through stories. We're used to having themes, characters, and that underlying narrative structure. We are wired to need those things. Consciously and unconsciously, we jam the messiness of the past into that narrative format, carving off rough edges here, leaving out inconvenient things there, picking our convenient starting and ending points because they allow us to make sense of this great morass of information. Telling a story that ends in a collapse makes this tendency glaringly obvious. The collapse is the climax, the denouement, the final act. Yet the past isn't actually a story, and collapse isn't actually the end. Merchants who'd made their living trading copper and ceramics between Syria and the Aegean fled the sack of Ugarit and began a second act elsewhere. Former Hittite administrators left Hattusha behind and became something else. Wherever they'd initially come from, some of the sea peoples defeated by Ramesses III were settled in Egyptian-controlled territory, took up new trades, and had children. Folks who'd grown up living in the shadow of palaces at Mycenae and Pylos in Greece lived on past their destruction and made conscious choices to live in a world that no longer had palaces. Whatever had happened, whatever mental and physical scars those who remained would bear, however the landscape had changed, life went on. This is the weakness of collapse as an analytical tool, to my mind. Because we're such narrative creatures, consciously and unconsciously, we have to see the collapse as the end. This makes it an apocalyptic occurrence, rather than simply something that may have been very bad for a great many folks, which shaped people and societies in profound ways, but which was ultimately a thing that gave way to another era. That's what today's episode is all about. Not forgetting about the Bronze Age collapse, not minimizing its many negative effects, as some scholars like to do, but instead focusing on how people got through it and what they did afterward. For what it's worth, I think this is the cleanest way of sidestepping sterile debates about collapse versus transformation versus change and all the various flavors thereof. We can acknowledge that bad things happened, that these led to some profound changes in everything from demography to political organization to settlement patterns, without committing the cardinal sin of acting as though it was the end. Because something did come next, and that was the Iron Age. A lot of pretty cool stuff happened in the Iron Age. And that's what the next season of Tides of History will be about. The Iron Age and how it led into the dawn of the classical period toward the end of the first millennium BC. This was the time that saw the Mediterranean become fully connected from one end to the other, the first sparks of long-distance trade along the Silk Road, and not least, the emergence of the two classical empires at either end of Eurasia, Rome and China. Of course, we'll also cover everything in between, including Phoenicians, Achaemenid Persia, Scythians, Etruscans, the rise of Buddhism, Celts, Alexander the Great, and pretty much everything else that comes up between about 1000 BC and 150 BC between Ireland and Japan. I'm pretty stoked about all of this, and episodes on these topics will begin, I think, right now, in December. But before we get to that, we still have some unfinished business in the second millennium BC. What kind of conditions did the Bronze Age collapse leave behind? How much of both continuity and rupture are we seeing, and how did that ratio of continuity to rupture vary based on where we're talking about? To the extent that collapse is in fact a useful category of analysis, a way of understanding the events and processes that happened around and after 1200 BC, we need to be nuanced about what we're including under that label. The only way to do that is to go region by region, trying to appreciate what changed and what stayed the same. And we need to do it in such a way that we don't automatically tar what came after the Bronze Age collapse as a lesser or devolved version of what had once existed. I'm not inherently against making value judgments about the past, but I think those judgments should revolve around whether things were worse for the people living there rather than whether there were fancy buildings, palaces, clay tablets with quantities of chariot building materials, and things like that. So that's going to be our goal for today, and we're going to start in the southwestern corner of the Bronze Age world, in Egypt. More than any other place, Egypt suffered the least from the series of upheavals that struck the late Bronze Age world. There's no evidence for sacked cities or burned palaces. We don't see mass graves, nor are there obvious archaeological signs of large-scale migration as either a cause or a result of political and social instability. If it weren't for the textual evidence telling us of Merneptah's defeat of the Sea Peoples around 1207 BC and Ramesses III's reportedly crushing victory around 1177 BC, we'd be hard-pressed to see much immediate disruption in Egypt at all. There are a whole bunch of different reasons for this. Because the Nile was the only real water route in and out of Egypt, much less of the country was exposed to potential seaborne dangers. Whatever we think of the Sea Peoples as a threat or a cause of late Bronze Age destruction, it's obvious that Egypt was simply less vulnerable than, say, the maritime cities of Syria. For that matter, since Egyptian control over the Nile extended so far to the south, and the country was bounded by deserts on either side, there was less to worry about on land as well. Second, and more important, the Egyptian state was significantly more resilient than the other late Bronze Age political entities. Hittite rulers were constantly fighting rival claimants to the throne and reinforcing their power over territories both near and far. Mycenaean Greece seems to have been full of political infighting. Egypt wasn't entirely free of internal strife at this time, but there seems to have been less of it, at least during that crucial period of collapse elsewhere in the eastern Mediterranean. Finally, the steady pulse of the Nile and its floods meant that agricultural yields were less immediately vulnerable to climatic disruption in Egypt than they were elsewhere. Rain-fed agriculture of the kind practiced in, say, Greece and Anatolia was at extremely high risk in the event of drought. The Nile floods are driven by a much different climatic system, the belt of rainfall that washes over the Ethiopian highlands every year from the Indian Ocean. The largely Mediterranean shifts that affected societies in Greece, Anatolia, Syria, and northern Mesopotamia had a markedly less serious effect further south. Whatever role climate played as a driver of the beginning of the Bronze Age collapse, it seems obvious that Egypt faced less danger from that specific shift than the other states in the region. The end result was that Egypt's new kingdom, which had controlled a unified state for almost four centuries by the time the Sea Peoples arrived in Ramesses III's reign, weathered the initial storm. Even after the kind of shocking assassination of Ramesses III in 1155 BC, his first several heirs managed to hold Egypt together for a while longer. Eventually, however, the new kingdom's luck ran out. Climatic shifts did eventually lead to below-average Nile flooding and droughts. Corruption and infighting among officials weakened the state. By around 1070 BC, the pharaoh's rule had shrunk to just a portion of Lower Egypt, and the Third Intermediate Period began.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
In previous episodes of Tides, we talked about the first and second intermediate periods of Egypt's history. These were the stretches of time separating first the Old Kingdom from the Middle Kingdom, and second, the Middle Kingdom from the New Kingdom. Both were defined by the lack of centralized rule in Egypt, with different kings holding sway in Upper and Lower Egypt, perhaps several in each at a time. The second intermediate period, of course, was defined by the rule of the Hyksos in Lower Egypt, the foreign rulers who were eventually expelled by the Theban rulers of the 18th dynasty. Neither the first nor the second intermediate period was particularly brief. They both lasted around 150 years, give or take, meaning that no fewer than five generations experienced life in Egypt without a single overarching pharaoh to whom they owed their allegiance. Rather than being brief interludes, they were major epochs in Egyptian history. The third intermediate period, however, was much longer than the first and the second. In fact, it was longer than both of them put together, lasting from around 1070 BC to 664 BC, nearly as long as the New Kingdom and longer than the Middle Kingdom. There were times of unified rule and even renewed empire during the Third Intermediate Period, but those periods never amounted to the long ages of efflorescence that we associate with the three classical ages of ancient Egypt's long history. So what happened? Why did Egypt not rise again, so to speak? Basically, the answer is political fragmentation. Egypt was never consistently unified long enough during this time for a single dynasty to cement itself as the unchallenged rulers of the country, to create the kind of institutional stability that defined the old, middle, and new kingdoms. There were periods of unified rule. Sometimes those periods lasted for decades, but they eventually ended in a return to the fragmentation that characterized the period as a whole. In the first stage of the Third Intermediate Period, beginning with the death of Ramesses XI, the last pharaoh of the 20th dynasty and the New Kingdom, the pharaohs of the 21st dynasty ruled only Lower Egypt. Upper Egypt, by contrast, fell under the sway of the high priests of Amun, based in the city of Thebes. The high priests also tried to retain control over Egyptian territory in Lower Nubia, further down the Nile, but the commander of the Egyptian soldiers stationed there effectively declared independence and fought off the Theban troops. Lower Nubia drifted away from Egypt after centuries of rule and grew closer and closer to the Nubian kingdom of Kush to the south. All of these developments were processes rather than one-off events. The high priests of Amun were able to independently rule Upper Egypt during the opening of the Third Intermediate because of the increasingly ineffectual rule of the last pharaohs of the 20th dynasty, still technically during the New Kingdom. Lower Egypt's drift away from Egyptian control was likewise a long and steady development. That was also the case with the increasing involvement of Libyans from the west in Lower Egypt, near the Nile Delta. This culminated in the emergence of a Libyan dynasty, the 22nd dynasty. The first pharaoh of this line, Shoshenq I, even briefly reunited Upper and Lower Egypt. So too did Piye, the Nubian founder of the 25th dynasty, who made sustained attempts to extend Egypt's rule into the Near East once again. Those attempts lasted until the Assyrians conquered Egypt, sacked Thebes, displaced the 25th dynasty, and placed puppet rulers on the throne. This inaugurated the late period and the last era of Egypt's independence. When we search for the beginnings of the Third Intermediate Period, they were firmly rooted in the Bronze Age collapse. Even though the New Kingdom managed to survive the initial catastrophes in the decades after 1200 BC, technically surviving more than a century more, this quote-unquote survival looks a lot more like a dynastic hangover than the continuation of the New Kingdom of the prior centuries that we're familiar with. The assassination of Ramesses III in 1155 BC sparked a series of succession crises, short and ineffectual reigns, and the eventual disintegration of the centralizing political institutions that had defined the New Kingdom. In essence, power and authority devolved away from the kings and their closest officials and toward the various localities that made up Egypt. This was precisely what had happened to create the first and second intermediate periods, for that matter. Trade with the outside world declined, the network of great kings scattered throughout the Near East no longer existed, and the wars of conquest and imperial accomplishment effectively ceased. All of that went hand in hand with the internal collapse of centralized authority. It's worth stopping for a moment to think about the dynamics here. We tend to think of centralized rule of a unified kingdom or empire as the norm, the baseline against which every other possible state of affairs is supposed to be measured. That's especially true in ancient Egypt, which had exceptionally long periods of stable, centralized rule and a shocking degree of continuity in political forms and royal authority. From this point of view, intermediate periods are aberrations. They're departures from that unified royal control that's supposed to define ancient Egypt. But as a great many scholars have pointed out, royal authority waxed and waned throughout even the most glittering periods of ancient Egypt's history. For every powerful ruler like Ramesses II, there were several like the boy king Tutankhamun and his immediate predecessors, who were shuffled onto the throne by the various power brokers within the army and officialdom. For every Khufu who built the Great Pyramid, there's a Pepi II, who came to the throne as a child and ruled into his 90s. Royal authority was minimal throughout Pepi II's reign. His pyramid was robbed immediately after his death, and the old kingdom effectively died with him, with power devolving to the nobility and local elites. The point is that royal power was a spectrum of possibilities, ranging from unchallenged control over a sprawling empire to something that effectively ended at the palace walls, if even there. Even in highly traditional and backward-looking Egypt, with the unifying Nile and millennia of traditions of kingship to draw on, centralized rule had to be constantly remade and transformed to suit the circumstances. For a variety of reasons, the various rulers of the Third Intermediate Period were never able to create a stable, long-lasting, malleable system of kingship to suit the times. There were still kings placing themselves in the same long traditions of royal authority. Many of the places from which they ruled remained the same. Language and writing remained, but there was no unification, no long-lasting efflorescence. The circumstances of the times didn't allow for that for a variety of reasons. Less favorable environmental conditions, a smaller population contained in fewer settlements than the peaks of the New Kingdom, and a more inward-looking political viewpoint despite far greater threats from outside Egypt's traditional boundaries, ranging from Libya to Kush to Assyria. But it's essential to note that the shifts that marked the transition from the New Kingdom to the Third Intermediate Period took place over many generations. Egypt's experience was one of gradual change, not sudden rupture. That's even more true for changes in settlement patterns and demography that we see in the Third Intermediate Period than in high politics. If Egypt found it possible to maintain its political solidity in the aftermath of the Bronze Age collapse, then it shouldn't really be surprising to us that the same held true elsewhere to an even greater degree. In my interview a couple of episodes ago with the archaeologist Claudia Glatz, she pointed out that among the Hittites, imperial power was constantly in the making. It wasn't a stable state of affairs, but something that every ruler had to enforce and incentivize. People, ranging from Hittite court officials to local elites to the farmers giving up a portion of their harvest and taxes, had to buy into the system. This is true of all state systems and all empires, but it seems to have been the case to a striking degree among the Hittites, more so than polities like Egypt or maybe Assyria at that time. Professor Glatz also writes at length about the imperial network, the system of ongoing relationships that constituted the Hittite domain. This was not a stable, bounded state of the kind implied by lines on a map that we see so frequently in depictions of the past. Instead, it was an amorphous, changing, and shockingly vulnerable entity. In the chaos around 1200 BC, with some combination of climate change-induced drought, serious famine, marauding sea peoples on the maritime trade routes and attacking key coastal cities, and incursions from the Kaska people who lived to the north and east, the Hittite state disintegrated. People opted out of participation in the complexes of relationships, king, officials, soldiers, subjects, that had comprised the state as a whole. Whether they did that because the system lost its legitimacy, because it had lost its ability to coerce, or because it no longer offered material benefits to its participants is up for debate. It's probably some combination of all of those. The result was a dramatic shift in what had once been the Hittite core area and in much of the rest of Anatolia. The Hittite capital, Hattusat, was abandoned. Nobody constructed monuments or massive fortifications in the Hittite style. Even pottery and settlement patterns shifted, perhaps because of some degree of migration into central Anatolia, an ethnic shift that went along with the political upheaval of the time. There were far fewer people living in the region in the centuries after the Bronze Age collapse than there had been before. In all of these ways, the Hittite imperial network seems to have been a remarkably thin veneer over the basic social, political, and economic structure of Anatolia and northern Syria. When the usefulness of that imperial network withered away, it simply disappeared. It's not hard to imagine former Hittite officials moving elsewhere and lamenting their loss of status. On the other hand, it's also not hard to imagine common folk who had once been subject to taxation or military service lacking much nostalgia for the way things had been. But the Hittites did leave a legacy, particularly further south, in the form of what are often called the Neo-Hittite states. There, in places like Carchemish, Aleppo, and a profusion of other city-states that had once been part of the Hittite Empire, some of the traditions stuck around. Luwian hieroglyphics, the script and language of choice for monumental inscriptions for centuries, remained in place. The Temple of the Storm God in Aleppo, a major cultic site during Hittite times, was renovated. So even though there were major disruptions, and the Hittite heartland was effectively emptied of its ties to a centuries-long political tradition, some aspects of their former power and influence lived on elsewhere. It might seem somewhat surprising that Syria, which suffered some of the greatest devastation associated with the collapse in places like Ugarit and Emar, would also see some of the greatest continuities with the prior era. But the urban network of the region was well established, its literate culture and political traditions were deeply rooted, and the concentration of people, craft production, and trade all maintained a critical mass of continuity. This was also true further to the west in Anatolia, in places like Luka, Lycia, and southwestern Turkey, where there isn't really a major rupture at the end of the Bronze Age. So even where there were genuine disasters, precisely the kind of destruction that we associate with sudden collapse, the overall urban culture and local political framework remained in place. This remained true despite the fact that places like Ugarit were never rebuilt. Further to the west, however, the Aegean presents a much stronger case of genuine transformation. There, in the lands over which the Mycenaean palaces had once loomed, life in the early Iron Age took on a dramatically different cast.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
The rapidity of the rupture in the Aegean, particularly in mainland Greece, is striking. Precise dates are hard to come by, but there's no unequivocal evidence of major shifts until right around 1200 BC. And then, within just a few decades, every one of the roughly two dozen major palaces had been destroyed or abandoned. These palaces had been at the center of the Mycenaean political world for more than two centuries. When they'd been destroyed before, either by war, internal upheaval, or natural disaster, they had always been rebuilt. That had happened on several occasions, including one rather widespread episode earlier in the 13th century BC. In fact, it would be surprising if buildings full of massive timber beams and flammable materials weren't regularly burned down and rebuilt, especially in a society that seems to have had a significant amount of conflict. On this basis, some scholars have argued for a general decline in Mycenaean Greece over the 13th century BC, a kind of a slow on-ramp to the Bronze Age collapse, but that seems to me like a case of knowing the ending of the story and looking for anything that might point in that direction. It's safer to say that the destruction that came around 1200 BC was unexpected, and it marked the beginning of a much more thorough and long-lasting change. This time around, the palaces were not rebuilt. The settlement system that had been built around them, with the palaces at the apex of a settlement hierarchy, shifted dramatically. Far fewer people lived in more spread out, less populous settlements scattered around Greece. Within 150 years, the dawn of the Iron Age in Greece, the population was perhaps half of what it had been when the Mycenaean kings had last ruled from their palaces. In all of these ways and more, the concept of collapse seems quite appropriate to describe what happened in the Aegean and Mycenaean Greece more specifically after 1200 BC. Older scholarship often called the period that followed the Bronze Age collapse a quote-unquote Greek Dark Age, in which civilization, monumental buildings, cities, states, and writing was totally lost, only to be rediscovered centuries later. Part of this idea of a Greek Dark Age was based on the belief in a Dorian invasion or migration that brought the ancestors of the people who in classical times spoke the Doric dialect of Greek and were known as Dorians. In this view, the rather less complex material culture and social organization that prevailed in Greece after the fall of the palaces was the result of the arrival of a new group of people from the north. Still Greek speakers, like the Mycenaeans, but with a different dialect and cultural practices. After many decades of work, however, there is no solid evidence of any significant population movement into mainland Greece during this time that we can associate with Dorians. Whatever the origins of the Doric dialect and the later Greeks' beliefs about the inhabitants of places like Sparta and Corinth, archaeologists have not found them in the transition between the Bronze and Iron Ages. Whatever the case may be with the Dorians, was this era after the palaces really a Dark Age? This is basically a question about the extent of continuity from the late Bronze Age into the early Iron Age. There's no strong reason to think that the people living in Greece weren't the descendants of their Bronze Age predecessors. We're not looking at an obvious migration and ethnic shift in the composition of the population. The people of the early Iron Age often made their homes on the same sites as their Bronze Age ancestors. Their methods of subsistence were broadly the same, and their craft traditions, like pottery, were clearly based on those of the preceding period. Thanks to the Iliad and Odyssey and the broader poetic tradition they represent, we can be sure that people in the Iron Age told stories that harkened back to the late Bronze Age. This is something we talked about a few weeks back, but there's an obvious core of genuine information about the world of the palaces in Homer's work, ranging from high-status items like boar's tusk helmets to the locations of major political centers. It is clear that the people of early Iron Age Greece felt a connection to their Bronze Age past. Even in the immediate aftermath of the most intense period of disruption, the way of life we see in mainland Greece, while simplified in some regards and altered in others, was still pretty similar to what had come before in most respects. People still sowed their crops the same way and kept the same domestic animals. They may actually have kept more of their produce thanks to the absence of kings skimming taxes off the top. They built their homes in much the same fashion, and even continued to build some larger structures, simpler than the old palaces, but still substantial buildings. Trade with the Eastern Mediterranean continued, albeit in much lower quantities. So as we try to understand the Bronze Age collapse and its aftermath in the Aegean, we have to balance the clear evidence of both radical change and obvious continuities. Some scholars, by ideological inclination or personal preference, have chosen to emphasize the continuities, going so far as to argue that Greece actually weathered the events around 1200 BC quite well, thank you. Others, by contrast, argue that the collapse really was a collapse, should be seen as a catastrophic process, and what followed actually was qualitatively different. On the whole, the balance of the evidence really does seem to point toward massive shifts after 1200 BC. Emphasizing these things doesn't make one a doomsayer. As the archaeologist Oliver Dickinson points out in his study of this transitional period in the Aegean, the events of the collapse must have been an extremely traumatic experience to live through. People died. Others left as migrants, never to return. Imagine never seeing your siblings or cousins or fellow villagers again because they'd left for, say, Canaan or northern Italy. Of course, there were survivors and people who stuck around, and of course they continued to build houses and plant crops and make tools in the way they had before. How else were they supposed to do it? I really like the way the archaeologist Alex Knodel wrote about this in a recent book, Societies in Transition in Early Greece. He doesn't downplay how disruptive the Bronze Age collapse was, nor how traumatic its events may have been for people who lived through them, but he does point out that the palaces were something of an aberration in the long run of Greek history. Mycenaean Greece had been a village society with some social complexity prior to the palaces' emergence around 1400 BC. It reverted back to being a village society with some social complexity following their destruction or abandonment after 1200 BC. In this sense, the political organization we see embodied in the palaces was a kind of veneer of a state-level society over a much simpler foundation. The collapse swept away that superstructure, it caused dislocation and disruption and death, but it didn't fundamentally alter the nature of settlement and life for most of the people who survived. Without the palaces, people simply went back to living in a simpler way. This doesn't mean the palaces didn't matter. They played key roles as centers of demand, institutions for redistribution, and holders of the wealth necessary to create and support a social elite. But their destruction wasn't the end. As we discussed earlier, building and maintaining states is hard. They have to be constantly made and remade, and in the absence of that effort, the states themselves just disappear. That was true in Hittite Anatolia, and it was true in Mycenaean Greece as well. The case of Assyria offers an illuminating contrast to what happened in the Aegean and Anatolia. Assyria reached something of a peak in the 13th century BC, largely at the expense of its neighbors, the Hittites in Anatolia and Syria, and the Kassites in Babylonia. After 1200 BC, however, Assyria fell into difficulties of its own. Two branches of the royal family effectively split the kingdom between them and fought it out until both fell into obscurity, replaced by a new dynasty. The evidence is exceptionally scanty, with few of the inscriptions celebrating great victories that characterize both earlier and later periods. This scantiness seems to be, at least in part, a reflection of a genuinely unsettled period for Assyria. Territory was lost in various directions, perhaps due to climatic issues such as droughts and inclement weather. Agricultural commodities were in short supply at multiple times. The internal conflict between claimants to the throne continued for decades. It wasn't until the very end of the 12th century BC that Assyria firmly remade itself as the greatest power of the region. But that didn't last long. After about 1050 BC, Assyria essentially retreated to its heartland for more than a century. It still existed, it was still a state, but it wasn't a dominating force in the politics of the Near East. That wouldn't happen for another 150 years, until the dawn of the Neo-Assyrian Empire at the very end of the 10th century BC. In summation, Assyria survived the Bronze Age collapse as a political unit, it briefly resurged as a major force, and then entered another period of survival, only emerging as an imperial power centuries later. While the regional trajectories differed greatly, there were strong similarities across this whole region of the Aegean, Eastern Mediterranean, and Near East. Populations fell, sometimes quickly and dramatically, and in other places and times more slowly and gradually. Trade, especially the bulk interregional exchange that had so characterized the thriving commerce of the late Bronze Age, greatly declined. The decline in trade and decline in population went hand in hand. The archaeologist Sarah Murray, whom I interviewed back in September, argued at length that at least in Greece, demographic losses mostly explain the seeming economic deterioration at the end of the Bronze Age and the beginning of the Iron Age. Fewer people meant less trade, and the areas with the most pronounced population decline, like the Aegean, were the areas that seemed to have experienced the most pronounced economic simplification. This also holds true for areas like formerly Hittite Anatolia and even, though to a much lesser degree, Egypt. There's no real question that the post-collapse Bronze Age and the beginning of the Iron Age were simply much less international and cosmopolitan. It's not particularly exciting to pin the blame for that on simple demography, but demography is the foundation on which everything else builds. As we've seen, this whole region experienced differing political trajectories in different places, but these trajectories involved remarkably similar themes of fragmentation and the devolution of authority from large centralized states to more local forces. Egypt effectively split into two different parts and lost its grip on its more distant territories in Nubia and the Levant. Assyria withdrew back to its remote core along the upper reaches of the Tigris River. Babylonia was overrun by the Elamites and spent several centuries bouncing between various short-lived dynasties. The Hittite Empire and the Mycenaean kingdoms disappeared altogether. All across the eastern Mediterranean and the Aegean, centralized authorities were no longer able to collect resources, build palaces and monuments, or wage war on the scale they had previously. But we don't have to characterize this general trend as a step backward for everybody involved. The flip side to the decline in centralized authority and large states was greater space for other smaller polities and alternative forms of political and social organization to flourish. The Neo-Hittite states of northern Syria are one example of this. The various Luwian kingdoms of Anatolia are another. Lots of people lived vibrant lives, sometimes better lives, in the absence of the authority of a great king who could enforce taxes and military service on the populace. Nowhere better illustrates the possibilities of this new era more than the southern Levant, the area known as Canaan, which stretched from today's Gaza through Israel and Lebanon to southern Syria. Canaan wasn't immune to the upheavals of the Bronze Age collapse, very much the opposite. Evidence of destruction dating to throughout the 12th century BC is plentiful. But unlike other regions, like the Aegean, the population of Canaan actually rose from the late Bronze Age into the early Iron Age. New migrants, identified as the Philistines, who had perhaps come from the Aegean, added to the existing inhabitants. In the absence of Egyptian, Hittite, and later Assyrian imperial aspirations, this whole area flourished. New kingdoms rose, like Israel and Judah. This was the context that produced the earliest portions of the Hebrew Bible and eventually Judaism. Coastal cities like Byblos and Tyre, already doing well in the previous age, became the most important trading sites in the Mediterranean. As the Phoenicians, they became the basis for a whole new program of exchange and colonization spanning everywhere from Cyprus to Iberia. The Bronze Age collapse happened. It was bad for a great many people, while others, probably fewer, benefited in the short term. Others made better lives in the long-term conditions that followed over the decades and centuries to come. But even in the places with the starkest differences between the prior world and the one that came after, life still went on. People woke up in the morning, hugged their children, tended their fields and flocks, baked their bread, made their pottery, and went on. They may or may not have been aware of the tremendous shifts that impacted their world. Some had fled from places like Ugarit or Mycenae or Troy and carried memories of fire and blood until the ends of their lives. Others, farmers living in an Egyptian village next to the Nile, barely noticed anything at all. Either way, and every way in between those two extremes, time did not stop. Those people had children, who eventually had children of their own, and so on down the generations until the next age, the Iron Age, dawned. But as we think about ends and beginnings, here at the end of an episode and near the end of this season, we have to return to their artificiality. Nobody who lived through the Bronze Age collapse knew it was the end of a defined period, nor did those who came after think they were living in a transitional age. The Iron Age that followed didn't announce itself. These are our constructs. They're our way of dividing up time and labeling them. They're our impositions on the actual flow of the past, not the past itself. People simply lived their lives, sometimes buffeted by the natural and human forces of their world, sometimes exercising agency, and always experiencing events and processes in the way that people do. It's my hope that the stories we tell, the narratives we craft about the past, do justice to those people, because they're the ones who matter. Next time on Tides of History, we'll be journeying to the north. We're going to step foot onto a Bronze Age battlefield, one of the most remarkable archaeological sites ever found in the Tollense Valley of what's now Germany. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. I've also written a book called The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, paperback, ebook, or audiobook from your distributor of choice. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Derek Behrens for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.